in the humanistic grounding argument for why those human rights are legitimate. It's not participating in the rational argument that in theory can be shared by everyone because it doesn't rely on some sort of particular system of faith-related or spiritual-related belief. And if it's not doing that, then it's part of a religious practice. And even though it might be very morally good or ethically good or have a good outcomes or whatever it might be, or, you know, have be good of heart, ultimately the moral authority so associated with it is some sort of religious or spiritual being that doesn't care for human rights. And the old problem of, you know, the problem of God and God's relationship to morality appears, as Annette points out, where it's like, well, what if one day, what if that religion turned out to be true? And, you know, God sent a message down one day that said, actually, you know, the stuff that you've been doing to help your fellow man is, like, we're going to cut that out. We're shutting that down. The religion would still be there. It would still be functional, although it would be considerably more disturbing. However, you would then see a very clear parsing of it. The overlap would be gone. And be very obvious that religion does not have anything to do with what we understand secular human rights to be.
So the angle that I was thinking of when I was thinking about the way that religion misses the mark in a way is that when you have a religious duty to do something and the religious duty issues from a commandment or from some kind of obligation, your obligation stems from that imperative. It doesn't stem from the nature of the thing to which you are to respect. I mean, it might differ given what the commandment issues to, but since we're talking about human rights, we're talking about humans. So say, for example, God commanded that you were to respect humans in some particular way. Well, the dignity that you are affording that human or the resources or anything like that, the reason you are doing that is because God commands so. Humans could be any particular way. They could have different rational structures or live different lives and stuff like that, or any modification to the way that a human is. That would be independent of any given command that God could issue you. And the reason that this drives a wedge between the religious and the secular practice of human rights is that when you are enacting human rights, you are essentially tending to the human. You are taking account of, okay, well, what is a human? What is a human need? What does human dignity look like? What does a good human life look like? You actually have to investigate the nature of what a human is and fulfill what reveals itself in that investigation to satisfy the flourishing of that human. You don't need a command to... This was something else that I was going to kind of bring up, which is this question of, well, if we don't have a divine commander and if all we have are these human rights, where do commands come from? When we investigate, say, for example, we go look at plants or something like that, and we see that, hey, they flourish in certain kinds of soil and certain kinds of conditions. If we construe ourselves as having obligations to these plants, well, then our obligations are to give them certain kinds of soil and give them certain conditions under which they would flourish and to maintain the integrity of the ecosystem that supports that and stuff like that. But we don't really, the imperative to do that, it issues itself from the observations, from the situation, from seeing that this is a particular thing, it has needs. And if we want to satisfy those needs need to be met under certain conditions, right? The imperative issues through observing needs, whereas you don't actually need to know the needs of any given human if you are given a command. you don't even really have to observe or look at the particular people, which in a way is kind of necessary for preserving the dignity of those people, right? Say you went into, I don't know, say there was a disaster and you went in to help the people that who were victims of a disaster. You might do it from a perspective of, okay, we know these people need, we've got water, we've got food, we've got shelter, we've got clothing, we've got medical assistance, all that stuff. That might be true, but you're missing what I think people would maybe poetically consider sacred about it. But if you're not really talking to these people, asking them their names, figuring out what they in particular as particular people need, we might say as a broad practice of doing this, listening to their stories or something like that, tending to individuals. If we're not doing that, then we are overlooking certain aspects of their dignity that are not, you can't issue that as a general imperative from a particular god or even from something like a human rights NGO.
If you're going to commit to human rights, then the roots need to be laid in the human beings themselves. And obviously those rights arise from, and Annette even says that it's very, you know, human rights from a secular level is pretty easy to do when there's like nothing at stake. And it's when, you know, it's when, you know, the real people are involved in real difficult situations and there's, you know, power imbalances and all sorts of complicated stuff that, you know, that human rights get kind of messy. And that's, you know, on some level, that's a reflection of, I think, the fact that they are, you know, human, emphasizing the word human rights, right? Like human people are complex. Their needs are complex. Their situations are complex. Their perspectives are complex. And parsing that out sometimes does require many different approaches. But that dignity can be, you know, at least from the perspective of the secular version of human rights, that dignity, that grounds can be found, you know, in the people themselves. You know, well, the answers
I'm not even saying they can be found there. I'm saying that's the only place to find them.
Yeah.
You have to actually go to the people who you're helping. You have to go to Jane and ask Jane, what do you need?
Well, in stepping away, I think that's actually a good, like we've more or less covered the article. There's some other little bits and pieces, but that's pretty much, you know, the general argument and structure. We were discussing beforehand our thoughts on the article, and I'll just come out and say that I'm very sympathetic to the argument. I'm very skeptical of the practice. And I think that this is a good way to actually like segue into that discussion. Because, you know, now we're talking about, okay, well, the only places to find human rights is the people themselves in their particular situation. To step back to the text for a second, Annette has this to say near the end of the article. There might seem to be a dogmatic anti-religiosity arising from my reluctance to admit religion as a legitimate player in the human rights game. I would say that it's not dogmatic, but there is a hint within that admission of it being, there's a distance there. There's a distance from what people actually experience on the ground. There's a distance from how people actually think of formulating their own values. Because the reality is while most people who think about human rights, or at least a lot of them, operate in a pseudo-secular intellectualist realm, the reality is that most people, especially people who are threatening other people's human rights or think theirs are being threatened, you know, in such cases, or are people who are in very, you know, groups of people who are in very dire situations, generally, it's not exactly secular concepts in the purest sense of the word that are kind of at stake, right? And what I mean by that is that most people in the world are deeply rooted in conceptions of identity and personal value that have deep religious, ethnic, cultural, and even economic or political systems, a deep immersion in those, which oftentimes very much trump the interest in a like secular objective human rights system coming into play. And this is this, you know, you and I have chatted about this before. We were chatting about it for listeners before the show. It's an issue that I had, like, I've been struggling with as someone who's been interested in philosophy for a long time, which is basically that, you know, philosophical discourse and a theoretical discourse oftentimes is very divorced or distant from reality. Reality is much, it's much more difficult is the bottom line. Like, it's just very, you know, it's very complicated. And people are not easy to deal with. Both, to be controversial, in difficult situations, both oppressors and victims are both can be very difficult to deal with. And oftentimes, those sorts of labels in those situations are not actually nearly as easily parsed out as we would want them to be, and as they often are in a theoretical system, right? Or even in a kind of reflection of past incidences and trying to, you know, tease out the human rights type, you know, system that we're trying to, like, impart in terms of what would be the best case, what would be the worst case. You know, it's easy to think of examples. One of the most obvious ones would be, citywide bombing during World War II, right? Like, in both Europe and Japan, both of those countries were very active in bombing their enemies and bombing civilian populations, obviously. But then that practice was turned around on them, 10 or 100-fold. Large portions of their civilian population were killed in very large-scale bombing operations, which more or less targeted civilians. Oftentimes they had ostensibly had military targets, but it was well known that, you know, bombing accuracy was not even close to being there, and you're basically just kind of flying over a large urban area that has a lot of industrial components and just letting it loose. Is that a legitimately ethical, like, action, right? If your goal is to defeat, you know, ostensibly genocidal imperialist empires, then suddenly is completely destroying their infrastructure at the cost of killing hundreds of thousands of civilians, you know, worth it? We're not going to have an answer here. This is, like, this exact example has been posed many times. But the point is more that, you know, even in situations that seem so clear cut, like, you know, the conflict in sides and relationship to human rights in World War II have complexities that are very difficult. And in which any system can, like, it seems like no system can actually fully encapsulate.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if part of the reason is that we come up with these frameworks, we have these theories, and, I mean, because part of the reason we come up with these theories is because we want to have a general answer, right? We want to satisfy that in advance of any given situation, we've got something ready. We are prepared. We've got the tools on our belt to deal with this situation. But we've looked over the nature of the situation, and it's that in any given particular circumstance, everything relates to everything. You can't possibly account for every circumstance in the way that it is going to affect things. There are always axes of cause and effect that are left unaccounted for, and if you just kept thinking about it, you just wouldn't do anything. I mean, we've come to the It's talked about. I find that philosophy students come up against this, and it is this distinction between theory and practice, the nature of thinking as an activity, how that intersects with what we consider other actions to be. So in this case, when we are going out there and actually, you know, enacting human rights or something like that, when we are supplying people in need with the resources they need to respond to violations of their human rights or something like that, you kind of just, in those circumstances, you do tend to particularities, but you don't tend to particularities in such a general way that you almost, like, get locked up in these continuous discussions of, okay, well, is what I'm doing really right or wrong? You just find yourself in a framework of, okay, these are our obligations based on these considerations for these people or something like that, you know, given the fact that they are humans, but being human also means being situated in a culture and having particular needs for being in that culture or something like that. And so we need to fulfill those needs.
I agree with what you're saying, but I think another component, and I've been trying to articulate this to myself, it is within the realm of the theory and practice distinction. I'm still trying to fully think about how to articulate this for, you know, myself, even myself and listeners, but I think the bottom line is that I think one thing that theoreticians really struggle with is the notion of bad actors. That they're theoreticians in general have a very tough time actually, or theories have a very tough time, most of them have a very tough time understanding people operating in real situations, and the fact that many people are not ethically good. Many people have vicious characters and motivations, and perhaps they might even be aware that that's the case, you know, versus the old Platonic view that, you know, people just do evil mistakenly. Perhaps so that's not really the case, and some people are well aware that what they're doing is terrible, but they just don't really care, or they like the benefits, and maybe that leads into Plato's point that, oh, they value something else wrongly more. But, you know, they're out there and they're doing that stuff, and they kind of screw things up, right? Like, and especially any sort of like defined system ends up being very susceptible to perversion. And we have a really hard time as theoreticians accounting for people doing that sort of thing, right? You know, I actually think the best example, controversially, probably piss some people off, but it's fine, would be Marx and Marxism, where, you know, you have a very robust, very complex system of economics and human freedom and potentials for, you know, a better, you know, human society that has never been enacted perfectly the way Marx, you know, set out. You know, we can grant that, but that's also because that whole system existed up until someone else taking it over in just Marx's head. Really, it was just one man with a system and, you know, intricately building layers upon layers upon layers. And as soon as that's passed off in other hands and other minds are involved, well, you know, if everyone was as well-meaning as apparently and hopeful and, you know, virtuous as Marx might, let's just suppose he was, the reality is passing that off to other hands, it becomes a system that is very easily corruptible into various kinds of authoritarianism and, you know, state control and all that kind of stuff. We don't need to go into the realities, but it's just a great example of like how, you know, a pseudo-utopian economic and social system can be very easily and very often is turned to completely different ends by the simple fact that other people are involved, that you cannot account for other people and what they're going to do with various kinds of systems and propositions. You know, and you see this with religion as well, like a lot. However, I think controversially that religion tends to be more stable, especially like, and even then I'm like, it's really not that much more, but large scale religious institutions do tend to, or at least have historically speaking, solidified considerably more into various kinds of traditions and theories and all this kind of stuff that are a lot more kind of grounded. Whereas, you know, this is the consistent problem of the inherently unstable nature of theoretical secular frameworks, where those sorts of things are effectively much younger, and so they can be brought up in, you know, all sorts of different ways that don't have to look as much to or rely upon the approval of tradition to work, right? You can kind of let loose.
Yeah, and I think too, because, and this goes to something we were talking about before the show too, that I think that each of the sides here, I think, appeal to different sides of the ontological coin, as it were, that maybe one of the reasons that something like religious traditions have the stability that they do is because they appeal to or attempt to appeal to something transcendental in us, something beyond the changing circumstances of our day-to-day lives, something that answers the question of how do we have some idea of eternity or infinity or something like that. It's solid in that sense. It concerns itself with being. But on the other side is becoming, the realm of the world, of changing circumstances, how things are always evolving. It's what makes, I think it's what makes theory and rationality and our minds and those sorts of tools appropriate for trying to tackle real world problems, because you need a pliable tool like the mind to be able to constantly be conforming to and attending to particularities in any given situation. But at the same time, it is going to need, it's going to need constant fuel. It's going to need constant rejuvenation. It can't appeal to a transcendental infinity. It has to rely on real people who see real things and who are motivated to do real things because of those circumstances that they see, because of the needs that they see.
You bring up a point, and it's one that certainly wasn't lost, especially in a lot of 20th century thinkers, where even our most fundamental and basic principles and truths are, due to their human nature, you know, and being in the realm of becoming, always already changing effectively. Sometimes it seems like religious institutions are more stable, right? They provide more stable basic principles, and within the relationship of human rights, you can ostensibly build off that, although if they're really human rights, like we said, is really up for debate. But even then, like, I think that really even religious institutions are just a symbolic version of being, right? Because even religious institutions and systems exist in the real world. And, you know, anyone who has any sort of interest, like I have, in passing, like, you know, religious histories and stuff like that, is even they are constantly evolving and changing and operating. There is, although sometimes the change is much slower and then more solidified, they do change, right? They do evolve. There is a shift. In fact, you know, we come around to say that, like, well, even those religious institutions are actually not proposing very stable systems, right? The stability that we want. And it's perhaps one of the great tensions of being a human being and being able to be theoretical in particular, is, like, we want answers, and especially we want answers that have, you know, an actual effect on our lives, right? Not just answers like how many sides does a triangle have, that seem to remain pretty consistent. You know, that becomes boring after age one. But yet we're always caught up in this drama of things just not really working out the way we thought they would. And it's very difficult, I think, for theoreticians to really reconcile that without coming to a kind of nihilistic end. Stepping away from what we've been talking about, but perhaps that's the real, like, wisdom found in philosophy. The well-living is the, you know, the acceptance or understanding, or, you know, living with the flow of the river that is always changing, as Heraclitus might say, as are you. But, you know, that's the only consistency. To think that you're going to come up with a system of human rights that everyone's going to agree on and set to and be willing to part with, and then particularly that that's going to be instituted in a political fashion that's going to have some consistent legs and strength to it, is already, things change too much. Like, to come to, like, a real political example of that, obviously the United Nations was, you know, created post-World War II as a relatively stabilizing force for, you know, things like human rights and disputes and those sorts of things. Especially in the 50s and 60s and 70s, it was much more involved and apparently seemed to have that role. Many people are very critical of the UN now for basically being completely ineffectual, and particularly for being very political, right? For people being very, of course, for it being very easily, like, in many people's eyes, corrupted. in the sense that, like, you know, all sorts of different people are coming to it with ends other than the ends of the UN itself. And that, like, by the virtue of that sort of structure, it's not functional anymore.
Right. Yeah. If human rights essentially are sustained by a particular kind of humanistic motivation, once that motivation is substituted by your own motivations, well, then what's the point?
Well, and I think the end point for the discussion is that, like, problem with this sort of, like, a building human rights systems from a secular component is that you're going to have, you're going to have humanistic motivations, but then oftentimes there's a poor understanding of what humanistic actually looks like. What we actually do is set out an ideal that is completely, oftentimes is very divorced from, I should say, the reality of, like, of the humanist existence, which tends to be considerably more selfish and narrow and difficult, a much more Hobbesian vision of what people are really like. Today, and you listen to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and we'll hope you join us next time.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors, and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role-playing, silent crimes broken, very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.
This is Bird Note. You don't need to travel to Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, or even to a remote forest, to see owls. Some owls, including big birds like barred owls and great horned owls, live in the city. Owls are hunters, and there's a lot to eat in the city, like rats or even squirrels. Great horned owls favor urban parks, cemeteries, and botanical gardens, places with big trees. They're huge owls with pointy, ear-like tufts, and they roost during the day in trees and hunt at night over open areas nearby. Look for something shaped like an enormous house cat sitting upright on a branch. At night, listen for these mellow hoots. Barred owls sound rowdy by comparison. The barred owl also likes parks, especially with open spaces below the trees, because it hunts mostly inside the woods. It's big, too, with a smoothly rounded head, and it sometimes perches down low, where it's easy to spot. We hope you can find owls near where you live. Take a pair of binoculars so you can watch them at a distance that's comfortable for you and for the owl. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Bird Note is supported by American Bird Conservancy, dedicated to conserving wild birds and their habitats throughout the Americas. Learn more at abcbirds.org.
Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM. broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.